I'm Jiryu. When I talked about a month ago, my partner Keishin's father had just died, and we were getting ready to go to Chicago for the funeral. But death had been unusually on our minds kind of all year. We've been going through this process together of just getting all our paperwork in order to be prepared to get old and sick and die. So that's the list that we came up with was we needed an advance directive, which says what medical procedures we want done if we're unconscious or unable to make decisions, and a healthcare proxy, which designates the person who will make those decisions for us. I said that basically I don't want any treatment if there's a good chance that I'll be mentally or physically impaired from some accident or some illness. And we thought about signing DNRs, do not resuscitate orders, but at least for me, I'm not even 40 yet. I kind of figured if I'm dead and somebody thinks they can revive me, they should give it a shot. Probably won't work, but, you know, go to town. We filled out wills. I willed everything to Keishin, but if she dies first, then everything goes to the Zendo. And also filled out funeral instructions. I said that I want my body to be donated to science. I found out what that actually means, which is that I'd be dissected by medical students for practice after giving away any organs that anybody might want. And then whatever's left of me should be cremated. And I don't think I left any instructions for where to spread the ashes. So if you're around, you know, figure it out. But I would like a memorial service here, you know, standard thing. I think that would be nice. So I'm more prepared for illness and old age and death than I had been before. And it feels really satisfying. Not really so much for myself, but just under those circumstances, I think it will be very helpful to whoever survives me if I've made some of the decisions and written down what I want beforehand. And I wrote an article with links to where you can find the steps that we took. Roshi shared it on the mailing list. I really encourage you to follow through on this stuff if you haven't done it yet. Let me know if you find more convenient ways of filling out this paperwork. It didn't really take very long. It didn't cost much. We didn't need a lawyer. But what I want to talk about today is, have I really prepared for death? There's a koan about this. In ancient China, a monk wanted to ask the teacher, Oman, how do I prepare to get old, to get sick and die? But since he was an ancient Chinese monk, of course, he didn't say that. He had some poetic way of expressing his question. He said, when the tree withers and the leaves fall, then what? And Oman said, the body is exposed in the autumn wind. Or in another translation I've read, the body is exposed in the golden wind. And I don't read any Chinese. I don't know where these two translations are coming from. When I read autumn wind, I think about the withering tree and the falling leaves, how the seasons change and everything ends. And then when I read golden wind, it brings me this kind of poignancy and beauty of being alive while we die. This sort of tastiness of living while we're dying. But either way, I think that Oman's answer is pretty clear. The monk asks, how do I prepare to die? And Oman says, The body is exposed in the golden wind now. I am being blown away now. Whatever I am is ending now. There is no preparing for this future when it's going to be over. This moment is already gone. Cause and effect, one thing after another, one person after another. I'm being blown around like a dry leaf now. I was 23 when my grandpa died. I was living in a monastery in Southern California. My job, I was Jikido at the time, and Jikido in this very austere monastery in a mountain in the middle of nowhere, it consisted of, at night, I would load firewood into this wood-burning cast iron stove in the kitchen so that in the morning, when I woke up in the dark before everybody else, I would light the stove, and while the kitchen was heating up, I would go upstairs to ring the big temple bell, which echoed throughout the valley and woke up everybody in their cabins so that they could come to the first meditation period. You know, first they go into the kitchen where it's warming up, they get some coffee, then they go into the zendo. And one night in October 16, 2003, I was loading the firewood into the stove when a monk came in and said, "Jesse, there's a call for you. You need to call the hospital. Your grandfather is dying." "I'll finish loading the stove for you. Go." And so I ran out to the trailer that we had, which was the only place that we'd run a phone line to, so that I could call the hospital. And I reached my grandma and I said, "Can I talk to him? I want to tell him I love him." And she said, "No, he's unconscious. He can't hear you. They've put him under." And I said, "Can you just put the phone up to his ear?" And she said, he won't hear you." So I walked back from the trailer to the zendo in the dark, and I was wearing sandals, and I cut my toe against a fucking rock, and I couldn't find a Band-Aid, and had to wrap up my toe in a paper towel and kind of like limp into the zendo with my foot bleeding into a towel and sit there and meditate. And then the next morning I flew to New York for the funeral. The last time that I'd seen Grandma and Grandpa was a few months before that. I had gone up to see them in Westchester before I started my year in the monastery. I wanted to hang out with them before I left. And Grandma and Grandpa and I took this little road trip up to that big Chinese monastery in Putnam County, Chuang Yen Monastery. It has an enormous seated Buddha statue. I think it's the largest in the West, and he is surrounded by kind of a stadium of little Buddhas, 10,000 of them all facing him. And everything is gilded and red and kind of over the top. Grandma and Grandpa weren't very impressed. They've never been into religion. Grandma kind of liked some of the stuff. Grandma was a great artist and a great gardener. And she liked she didn't like the statues, but she liked the ink drawings on some of the walls of the arhats. These are these like gnarled old wise men and women, the enlightened ones of the ancient past. And they've got these kind of like gnarled noses and hunchbacks, and they're frolicking together out in the wilderness. Grandma really liked those drawings, and she also loved the gardens. They were vast and full of all kinds of plants from all over the world. Grandma went off to explore the garden, and Grandpa and I sat down on a bench in the sun, Grandpa said, I don't know why I'm always so tired anymore. He'd been diagnosed with aortic aneurysm. The aorta is the big artery in the middle of us, and an aneurysm is when the artery weakens and kind of swells out like a weak balloon, and eventually it bursts. Grandpa said, I don't know if it's just being old or if it's the aneurysm that makes me feel this way, but he thought that sometimes he could feel it pulsing inside him. And I wanted to somehow offer him some sort of method for confronting this uncertainty, knowing he was going to die, but not when. But sometime suddenly and soon it was going to happen. And I also wanted to give him some kind of method for making the most of his life while there was still time. I was like 22, I was into all this stuff to try to fix my life. I wanted to try to fix his life too. I'd been doing this self-help group called Landmark, and of course I was into meditation and Buddhism, and when I was younger I'd done therapy. I wanted him to do like something to change his life as a response to this diagnosis. And Grandpa just was not interested. Grandpa was fine with his life the way it was. He faced death just unarmed, without any method. In Zen, we talk about stepping forward from the top of a 100-foot pole. That's what he was getting ready to do, without a net. A couple of days later, I went to California, and a few months after that, his aorta burst, and within a few hours, he died. Body exposed in the golden wind. The teacher Shui To wrote a verse about that phrase. He said, over the great plains, chilling wind blasts, howling, wailing. In the eternal sky, intermittent misty rains. I think I understand what he's talking about. That's what it's like. The plains are perfectly flat, unchanging and permanent, but even so, the golden wind just howls through there, tears everything up, throws around the trees, destroys everything. Even though the eternal sky is beautiful and pure, the misty rain comes and goes and reveals it and conceals it. Dying, or knowing somebody who dies, is an obvious demonstration of this golden wind, but it's here in our lives all the time. I particularly notice it when I do street retreat, and it's on my mind because I'm going to do one in a couple of weeks. It's this practice where you leave behind your wallet and your cell phone and your stuff and go and live on the street for a few days with a small group of other Buddhists, and we sleep and meditate and eat in soup kitchens. And it's not very long, but the first time I was gonna do it some years ago, it just scared the shit out of me. I was so afraid to go out and be on the street without my stuff. And in that period, when I was, in the days before I went out on the retreat, I had this very strong sensation that I was preparing to die. And of course, I knew it was an illusion. I was just going to be uncomfortable for a few days. But I had this sense that everything that I appreciated about my regular life in my apartment and my job, I was about to renounce it all forever. I would never get it back. And that brought a special tastiness to those couple of days beforehand. Like, breakfast before I left for the retreat that morning was the best. The day before, I'd gotten caught in the rain, and when I got home and changed into dry clothes, it felt so good, because I knew that if I got wet during the retreat, I would just have to stay wet. And that, that special appreciation, that tastiness, that continued once I started on the retreat. I slept with a group in a parking lot, and then the next morning, we got up before dawn and we went up to wait in line outside a soup kitchen. There were four of us on the retreat and we were sitting lined up along a stoop. And while we were waiting, some kid, lanky teenager, came walking down the block with big headphones on, kind of not looking around at anything. And as he passed us, he pulled out a wad of bills and he just dropped a dollar in each of our hands without losing the beat or breaking stride, just 1, 2, 3, 4, generosity. And then a little later, a guy came walking down the street and he was talking to himself, or maybe he was talking to, maybe he was on an earpiece. I couldn't tell. You can never tell if somebody's crazy or not. But his tone of voice was so ordinary. And then once he'd passed us and I could see around to his other shoulder, I saw who he was talking to. He had a big red parrot riding on his shoulder. This stuff is happening everywhere in New York. And I see it a lot, but street retreat is special, you know? Because when you know that you can't get or spend, and that you cannot hold on to this moment because you don't know what's going to happen next. You can't plan. So the only thing you can do with this moment before it dies is to just look at it and appreciate it. And I really enjoy that aspect of it. These days, I don't get very scared before I start the retreat. I'm kind of looking forward to it, because I kind of enjoy just like stepping out of my apartment door and just getting blown all over for a few days. The wind might blow in good weather, might blow in rain, might blow me up to Central Park to take a nap, might blow me down to a soup kitchen downtown to have some completely unpredictable conversation with a street person. You know, you never know what's going to happen. And in that way, it's like ordinary life. And so I think that this is why Zen people talk about death all the time. One thing is that we're factual people. We like to acknowledge the fact. One reason is that it's a teaching that helps relieve suffering, because as we acknowledge that we are impermanent and we can't be saved, it decreases our attachment, right? We believe a little less in these tiny losses and victories of our days when we know that it's all going to be over. But also there's, you know, this special appreciation, this special taste that life has, because we know that we can't hold on to it. My mother plans to die when she's 85. She's a philosopher and a medical ethicist, and she's thought about this very carefully. And she's committed to living only so long as her mind is sound and she can make decisions for herself. She's thought this way for many years, but particularly now that she and I have had to watch Grandma die. After a very long decline into dementia and senility, Grandma was, I think, 97 when she died. She was way too old. She lived way too long. And Mom is determined not to have to live through that. So if she makes it to 85, she'll kill herself. And that's become much less abstract for me in recent years, both from Cation's father's death and also just that my mother is nearly 70. And I can kind of see her 85th birthday from here. You know, 15 years. I know what that feels like. I've lived 15 years a few times. It's finite. And I don't really know exactly what's going to happen, of course. Like, the wind could blow us around any number of ways. Mom could die before 85, or she could change her mind, decide to live longer, but she is so determined that I think that what she plans is a fairly likely outcome. And so just now I've started to think for the first time, what's that last year going to be like? Her 84th year. And I think it's going to be wonderful. I think it's going to be like breakfast before you go on a retreat. I think it's going to be like looking at the bright autumn leaves, knowing that they're about to fall. I think it's going to be tasty. So I mentioned this Zen phrase, step off the top of a 100-foot pole, or take the forward step from a 100-foot pole. What's that about? It's used in a koan in the Gateless Gate. Which goes, Shi Shuang said, how will you step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole? And commenting on this, another teacher said, even one who is sitting on the top of a 100-foot pole has entered the way of awakening, but it is not yet authentic. You must step forward from the top of the pole and manifest your whole body throughout the 10 directions. So, like with most Zen sayings, I've spent many more years misunderstanding this than I have understanding it. It's a trap, and it trapped me. You know, it trapped me into thinking that practice is like, with great effort, climbing your way up to the top of this 100-foot pole through rigorous method and great effort until you finally reached the apex of Zen. And only then is your reward that you can take the forward step and fall. Letting go of all method, letting go of practice, and just like, just be, man. Thought that that would be total mastery. And I often kind of think of my life this way too, as this struggle to reach the top of like a greased pole. It takes huge strength to reach the top of it. And most days I think of my life this way. I have a file on my computer that I write down the main things that I accomplished every day. Did I fix a bug or optimize a piece of code or finish a blog post or publish a photograph? And every day the list gets taller and taller and taller until I die, and then I'll fall off. But it's a total fake out. Because I'm already falling off the pole. Right? I've been falling since before I was born. And there's no way to prepare for impact because there's no ground to hit. You know? And we're all like this. We're just falling leaves, blown around by the golden wind, cause and effect, one thing after another, blown around in all the 10 directions. Whatever we have now, whatever we've accomplished, whatever we are, it's exposed in the wind and it's being blown away right now. And without any control over it, really the only thing I think that we can do about that is just enjoy the ride.